Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast.
Hello.
I am Damien O'Carroll.
I'm David Linklater.
And we have to start off with an apology. It's been a very, very long time since you've heard from us.
It has. It's been so long, I actually am too scared to even think about how long it is. We've got a good excuse. Well, number one is that we're quite lazy. Number two is there have been quite a few changes in our lives, or
indeed,
in mine at least. I've given up the fast and loose world of freelance motoring journalism to go and work at Fairfax Media. So I now write for online publication stuff.co.nz and also all of the Fairfax newspapers like the Press, Dominion Post, and occasionally Sunday Star Times. So go on to Stuff, please, and if you see a motoring story by me, click on it several thousand times, ideally.
Of course, you're underselling it. You've got a fancy title too.
I have. I don't want to say my fancy title.
You're a channel director.
Yeah. But I'm not on the telly.
Not on the telly, no. Of course, I've been very busy myself taking up the work that you used to do at the New Zealand Herald.
Yeah,
so
it's hard, but it's poorly paid.
Yeah, there's that. Anyway, we're here now, we're back into it, and we've got a cracking podcast.
A cracking podcast. We're not actually back into it in the usual way, though. We're actually sitting in a car at the moment.
We are.
We're doing it on one of our in-car podcasts. We're sitting here in a another quite special vehicle. We always say it's a special vehicle.
Well, it has to be, doesn't it?
But we wouldn't be in here if it wasn't special. So what we're going to do this podcast is we're going to have a little bit of a chat. We're going to dispense with the usual news. We're going to have a bit of a chat about the New Zealand Car of the Year because the shortlist has just come out.
That's right. That's the big news in the New Zealand motoring world.
Do you know what? When we did our first podcast, that was the first thing we talked about.
It was indeed.
The New Zealand Car of the Year shortlist.
Yes.
So it's been a year.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
That just shows how long it's been since we did the last one because we've done 12 podcasts.
We are going to have a bit of a chat about the Car of the Year shortlist. We are going to go for a little bit of a drive in this car, which is a 12-cylinder car.
It is.
And to celebrate that fact, we're going to have a bit of a chat about 12-cylinder cars
while we
drive as well. But why don't we just launch right into the Car of the Year podcast?
Why don't we?
So Car of the Year is chosen by the New Zealand Motoring Writers Guild, of which we are members, and the AA, and a committee gets together every year and chooses what it decides is the best 10 cars launched that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then that shortlist goes out to the general membership for voting and we get a winner. So we're just at the shortlist stage at the moment. So how do you reckon we should run through them? We won't dwell on them too much.
No, I think we'll just...
let's do them in reverse alphabetical order.
Okay, that's good.
Mix it up a bit.
That is good.
So the first one is the Volvo XC90.
Yes.
Which is actually a car we've talked about
before.
Which
we actually did, I believe, the last podcast we did was from the launch of the
XC90. I can't remember back that far.
No, it was quite some time ago. But anyway, we didn't talk about the car at the time because we hadn't actually driven it. But we have both driven it since then. And it's
do we like it?
I rather like it indeed.
It's a bit mumsy, isn't it? It's like a soccer mum's car.
It is, but it's very minimalist and classy.
It is.
I think it's got probably
quality.
One of the best interiors in a car on sale today, to be honest.
Oh, I would say second, probably in terms of sort of SUVs and maybe cars as a whole, probably second only to the Range Rover for really classy sort of SUV interior. The XC90, of course, if people don't know what it is, being Volvo's big 7-seat SUV, so it's a big thing.
But it's got a trick up its sleeve in that it's a very big SUV with
very small engines.
Very for small engines.
Yeah.
So 2-litre 4-cylinder engines, in fact, is all it comes with.
Yeah, there is actually a plug-in one coming as well. It's not here yet.
No.
It's not here yet,
no.
But it's coming, I think, before the end of the year.
Promises to be quite the angry performance version too, doesn't it? Because it's got quite serious numbers.
As well as being able to sort of do your commuting on electric power, and I think it'll do something like 40, 50 Ks on electric power. Mm. It's also the performance flagship of the range, so that'll be an interesting
one. That'll be an interesting
one. That's not being considered the Car of the Year.
No, that one doesn't count. No, but I think it's... and with quite a strong chance, because it is an exceptionally good car.
Speaking of SUVs, Segway.
Oh, nice.
Speaking of SUVs,
nice.
Subaru Outback is next on the list.
But it's with something else.
It is. It's with the Legacy, because we've decided that the Outback and the Legacy are the same car.
Doesn't matter what the people that make it want. We have decided they're the same car.
They are, in fact, on the same platform.
They are.
As we've probably talked about this many times before.
Yes, I'm sure.
But there's no longer a Subaru Legacy wagon.
No.
Because there's just no market for ordinary wagons like that. Everyone wants SUVs. The Outback has always been based on a Legacy. So there's a Legacy sedan and Outback wagon.
Yeah.
To us in the motoring journalism fraternity, they're the same thing. So.
They're very similar to drive. You know, you could take the Outback a little way off-road, but...
only a little way.
Only a little way, and the Legacy you can't at all, of course.
You could try.
You could by accident. Again, in
Do we like the Legacy? I like the Outback. It's not dramatically different, actually, from the Outback that's been around for like 20 years, but it's just a really accomplished vehicle. Does everything really well.
Seem to make it just that little bit better every time they do another one.
They do. And it's a very influential vehicle. It's really one of the first crossover type vehicles. It was one of the first vehicles that sort of blended, you know, a normal station wagon with sort of SUV ride height and styling and what have
absolutely.
You. Not that that should get it any points for Car of the Year, probably, because it's got to be judged on its own merits. But it's always been a great vehicle, and the new one is especially good.
And the new Legacy, too, is particularly good, even though they are the same. Calling them the same thing.
It's got a boot,
but it's possibly even a bigger jump over the old Legacy than the Outback is over the old Outback.
Absolutely,
which is going a bit against what we were saying about them being the same car. But
they've taken it in a slightly different direction.
It's more
of a sports sedan. I think they realise that the market for that type of conventional sedan is shrinking, so they've tried to make it a bit special. Yep. And actually, they have. The 3.6-litre six-cylinder one in particular is a great car. Well, they call it the RS, which is a bit of a desperate attempt to make it sportier than it is. Probably,
that's a bit cheeky, really.
But it's
not
a good car.
It's not the old Japanese import RS wagons of old that they used to get. But
there
it's still
no
a good car.
Turbos involved.
No turbos, no. But it's
right.
An excellent car.
From one extreme to the other, Mazda MX-5.
I just love this MX-5.
You sounded almost sarcastic.
No, I adore it. I absolutely love it. It's the new MX-5, for those of you who don't know, is actually virtually the same size as the original one now, I believe.
It is. It's tiny.
It's absolutely minuscule.
Not that the previous generations have been particularly large.
But this one is...
When you go from one to the other, which we did on Mazda's press launch, actually, we were able to drive all of the generations together on track. And when you go from the previous generation to this one, the new one is tiny. In a good way.
In a great way. Except, I mean, I found that when I had it for a week, I found it easier to actually open the door, reach in, pop the roof, flick the roof back, hop in the car, and then put the roof back up again. Than actually trying to...
Folding yourself in.
Yeah, to clamber down and into the car. But I mean, I actually quite like that.
Yeah. No, it's a neat little car. The one that we've driven thus far is the 1.5-litre one, which is sort of another throwback to the original, the downsized engine. Mm. There is a 2-litre one coming. But the 1.5 is kind of the hero model in some respects.
I loved it.
It's sort of the purest version.
It is.
Which is what an MX-5 should be.
Absolutely.
It should be
weighs next to nothing, and it's got a tiny little engine that gets it along at enough speed.
Not much speed.
Not much speed, but more than enough.
That's not really what the car's always been about, though. It's about...
I mean, as an example, I had a Toyota 86 at the same time as I had the MX-5.
Show off, yeah.
And the 86 actually felt... big and slow and hefty after jumping into it. I mean,
the 86 is also a tiny car, so
it's
an illustration of how small the MX-5 is.
The 86 actually felt like the practical car to take to the shops.
Do you know what? There's another Mazda on the list.
There's a number of Mazdas on the list. Without spoiling
to spoil
the
surprise! I was just setting us up for that.
As soon as I said that, I thought you were going for that.
You've blown it. Mazda CX-3.
Brilliant little car.
So this is like a baby SUV.
It is.
Which is sort of the hot segment at the moment. Lots of car makers are introducing tiny SUVs.
I mean, to be fair, and Mazda probably won't like me for saying this, it's actually more of just a little hatch.
It is. It's a little hatch that's a little bit higher than a normal hatch. We've talked about the CX-3 already a little bit, haven't we? We talked about that last podcast too, because we all agreed that it was a fantastic looking car, because we did the best looking cars.
That's right, we did, yes.
So it is a great looking car. It looks a little bit like a Range Rover Evoque, actually.
Yeah. It's got that.
And it's got the sort of blacked out pillars and things. And it's good to drive too. There's petrol and diesel ones.
Brilliant interior.
Ticks a lot of boxes.
It does. So, yeah. I think a lot of Mazdas are these days. As we have seen.
Yeah.
By the surprise I've just given away.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to ignore what you said before. And I'm going to go, do you know what? There's another Mazda.
No!
The Mazda 2.
Yes.
Now, the Mazda 2's been out for a while, hasn't it?
It just snuck in. Yeah, it was just in the cutoff.
It was almost eligible for last year's, but it was carried over to this year. So, again, another sort of new generation Mazda.
Yep.
They've basically renewed their entire model range now.
They have, yeah. Everything looks good. Everything drives brilliantly. They've got a great range of engines. And, I mean, that's showing here. Obviously, a lot of people feel the same way.
Probably prior to the CX-3 and the MX-5, we would have raved on about the Mazda 2 and what a tremendous vehicle it was. But
It's kind of a bit overshadowed by the other two.
It is. It's a rather conventional little super mini, but it's still really accomplished. Looks really good. It's got a great interior. It's got some good safety features in it.
Absolutely. Quite high spec, even the lower models.
Yeah. So next on the list, Land Rover Discovery Sport. Not a Discovery.
Not a Discovery. So not a big, not a huge one.
Discovery Sport.
And yet still a seven-seater, even though it's probably more of a mid-size.
It is. So it's a mid-size SUV. It's probably closest in size to a BMW X3 or an Audi Q5, so that sort of thing. But it does have seven seats.
It does. I believe it's the only one in that segment that's a full seven-seater.
And that's kind of the Land Rover thing they're all about. I mean, Land Rover is a lot about showing off and looking cool. But they do also have this sort of functional ethos, so they're all about practicality. So, you know, it's a hard-wearing vehicle. It's great off-road. It's got lots of practical features. For example, every seating position has a USB port. So it's a real kind of family vehicle. It looks fantastic. It sort of looks like a slightly more utilitarian version of the Evoque.
Well, that's anything about it that kind of confuses me a wee bit, and that I really love it. I think it looks great, but it looks like a Range Rover.
It does look like a Range Rover.
And it sort of that dilutes it for me, but I mean,
that's not going to be a minus for people who are buying it. They'll love the fact that it looks like a Range Rover.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it does. It looks a lot like a Range Rover Evoque. Yeah,
it's got a brilliant, amazing interior. Really, really good interior in it. Just everything about it's really, I mean, and it's another of these new breed of off-roaders that annoy the hell out of the old purists, which I love it for, by not having any low range but still being remarkably good off-road just with its electronics. And
it is that's something that Land Rover and Range Rover still absolutely committed to. You know, they put a lot of work into making their cars drive really well on road, but they're still exceptional off-road.
Absolutely.
So yeah, clever cars.
Yep.
Hyundai Tucson.
Yes.
That's not an off-roader.
That's not really an off-roader, no.
And the Tucson is the model. It's a brand new model, obviously, but it's the sort of segment entrant that you might previously have known as the iX35, because for reasons unbeknown to anybody, Hyundai kept changing their minds about what they call their cars. You know, there was a Sonata sedan, and then there was they called it an i45.
Yes.
And then they called it a Sonata.
Sonata again, yes.
And they've done the same with the Tucson. Yeah. It used to be called a Tucson years ago. Previous generation was an iX35, now it's back to Tucson.
Yes. Again. Apparently people identify better with names rather than numbers. I'm sure BMW would disagree here.
Or lots of other
manufacturers.
Anyway, we're getting distracted from the topic in hand, which is whether the Tucson's any good.
The Tucson's very good. I mean, for a start, the big thing about it is it doesn't look like an iX35.
It doesn't look great. It looks like
a mini Santa Fe.
Junior Santa Fe.
It's fantastic looking. I mean, the iX35 was another one of the vehicles that we agreed, anyway, of being the ugliest vehicle.
Yes. Whereas the Tucson is actually quite handsome.
Great looking car.
Looks really good. It's got lots of new technology in it. It's got Apple CarPlay in it.
It's the first car to go on sale with
Apple CarPlay.
Indeed.
And it's probably really tragic that that's a talking point, that something that you can do on the touchscreen with your phone is worthy of talking about, but that's the reality these days.
So it's absolutely
a feather in Hyundai's cap being first with that.
And it's got quite a lot of sort of that new technology for its segment too.
Yeah.
In terms of driver assists and things that...
good petrol and diesel engines. Mm. Probably more diesel than petrol, actually, if you're getting excited.
Although
it's a good petrol turbo, isn't it?
Yeah, the little 1.7 petrol
that
turbo.
One,
that's a fantastic little engine.
Yeah. But the diesel, the I drove the diesel great. One, diesel yep. four-wheel drive. It's got heaps of grunt.
And it actually covers a vast, vast ground in terms of price and spec. It goes from about 39 grand, I think,
up into the 60s.
Yeah. So,
which is a lot for a mid-size SUV.
It is.
As I keep pointing out to people, a top-spec Toyota RAV4 is in the 60s.
Exactly.
So it's not outrageous. But that'll be an interesting one. And it'll probably be quite a big selling vehicle in New Zealand, I think.
Hyundai
does
well
with its
SUVs. Yeah.
Ford Mondeo.
Yes.
My God, do they still make a Ford Mondeo?
They still make a Ford Mondeo, even though no one buys sedans. Well, it's not actually available as a sedan. It's only as a hatch or a wagon.
It's sort of a sedanish hatch.
It is. But it's definitely in that mid-size sedan segment that no one really...
Yeah, it's sort of your fleet/business car. And a lot of those fleet/business people are going to SUVs like everybody else. But anyway, Ford persists with a Mondeo.
It's a thoroughly brilliant car, too.
It's taken a long time to get here, though.
It has. It's
been on sale in the States, I think, for two, even
three
maybe 3 years.
I think it was
launched 2012.
Yeah.
It's called the Ford Fusion over there. Mm. So it's taken an age to get here. Having said that, it's still a really competitive car. It's it drives really well. It has got tons of driver assistance technology.
Absolutely.
And safety
it's
technology.
Just packed full of
including
all sorts of stuff.
The version I drove had inflatable rear seat belts.
Yes.
So
which is a Ford invention, I do believe. They spent a lot of time.
Mercedes have it too, though, don't they? Did Ford invent it?
That threw you for me. I don't know. I was guessing. I think so. No, I think so. I think Ford did invent it.
Do you know what? A guess is good enough here. I do know that Mercedes-Benz has inflatable rear seat belts in the S-Class.
Well, maybe it was just Ford's PR that made it sound like that.
Yep. Anyway. Lots of, adaptive cruise control and all that sort of
business. I must say, one of the best lane assist systems that gently guides you back into the lane if you start wandering. It is completely unintrusive, unlike some systems that panic. But
Do you know what I've realised? Sitting in a car in the afternoon in the sun with no engine running because you don't want it to interfere with your recording, it's
quite unpleasant,
effing hot.
Isn't it?
Just saying, people, if we start to talk nonsense, it's because we're delirious.
Anyway, two cars to go, and then we can get on to the...
Oh, okay. BMW i3. I've got one of these at home at the moment.
I had one last week and absolutely fell in love with it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's actually the second go I've had in the
i3. Yes, I've had goes in it before. But
so the i3 is BMW's little electric car, in case people don't know. You'd know it if you saw it.
Looks like something from
the near future.
Nothing else.
Yeah, it's all made of... They call it carbon. Lots of people call it carbon fibre. It's not. It's carbon fibre reinforced plastic.
Yes, that's right.
It's a plastic car.
It's a plastic car.
In fact, there's no steel in the car, I think, apart from a couple of bolts.
Really?
So it's all either aluminium, carbon fibre reinforced plastic, or plastic.
Wow. So I did not know that. That's interesting. Because it is a very, very clever little car
in
terms of its construction and its packaging. And I think that's the other car that was sort of up for consideration for the top 10 was the Audi A3 e-tron.
Yeah.
And it's a far, far more conventional car. And but a very good car.
Yeah.
Excellent
I think the
car.
Big difference between the two is that the A3 is very much a conventional car that happens to have a little bit of electric range. The i3 was designed from the ground up as an electric car, and it's got fantastic range.
Yes.
It'll do well over 100, but up to 150 if you're super, super careful on battery.
I think about 115, 120 is reasonable out of just normal
that's
driving.
What you could normally expect. And also, there's a petrol generator on board, so if you do get stuck or run out of juice, that will take you another 100, 150.
By petrol generator, you mean a tiny little scooter engine that jammed in the back that kicks into life.
And it is such a beautiful car to drive and so quiet because it's electric that when that little scooter engine kicks into life, it scares the life out of you. It's so loud and it just chugs away because it doesn't drive the wheels, of course. It just generates electricity.
Yes.
So
which is the point of difference between the i3 and any other range extender car on sale in New Zealand is that it purely is just there as a generator.
And I would call it an emergency generator because you wouldn't want to drive around. It's so noisy. Actually, another fact, which I learnt on the BMW 7 Series launch, carbon fibre reinforced plastic has many, many great qualities. It's light, it's strong, very poor noise suppression.
Yes.
And very stiff. So that's arguably one of the reasons why that car's so noisy when the little engine kicks in. But it sends you scuttling back to the PowerPoint anyway to plug it in, and good job too.
But I mean, I had the thing for 4 days, and I plugged it in once while I was at a mall that had parking for electric cars for about 2 hours, and that was it. I actually didn't need to charge it other than that. So, I mean,
so all you're really doing is telling people that you don't get out much. I've been plugging it in a lot.
Okay, fine. But there's really no need to actually kick in the petrol engine to kick in at all unless you're going on a long journey out of town.
I mean, realistically, if you say 300 km range total, that's enough to see most people through a week probably, if need be.
Yep.
You know. So if you're plugging it in occasionally, then you're sweet. Exactly. It's a really viable electric car, and that's why it's on the list. Plus, it's really cool.
It is cool. It is cool.
And from something sort of radical to something probably quite conventional, an Audi Q7.
Yes. Now, I didn't like the last Q7 in the slightest.
No, it was hideous.
It was awful, and it was not very nice to drive, and it was just...
Very American.
Very American.
This one's quite European.
This is very European. In fact, you would almost be tempted to describe it as a very large hatchback.
Yeah, it actually looks
it looks like a large.
Oddly. Yeah. Because Audi's quite a design sort of lead company, but oddly, this car looks quite conservative and quite conventional. Mm. But they've done a really neat trick. When you look at it, it doesn't look very big.
No,
it's
not
actually
at all.
Larger than the old one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. But this is lighter, I believe.
Yes, much lighter.
Much lighter, but larger.
Like hundreds of kilograms.
Yes, because the last one was extraordinarily heavy.
So I guess part of the reason why it's made the list is that although it's a big sort of, well, what might outwardly seem quite a profligate sort of car, they've actually done a lot of work to make it more efficient and sustainable. And it's another car that's loaded with driver assistance.
Absolutely packed with it, yeah.
Which is another reason why it's on the list.
Yes.
It's really, they claim, I don't know if I believe this claim, but they claim that it has more driver assistance and safety technology in it than any other car on the market. I would dispute that because I'm looking at the car we started with, the XC90,
and it's got quite a lot.
At least as much, if not more.
Well, even the Mondeo has quite a lot too. Yeah.
So take that with a grain of salt. But the point is the Q7 is very, very high tech, really impressive, and much more efficient than the old one.
Absolutely. Plus, it brings back, after a slight pause, one of our favourite technologies of old days, four-wheel steer.
Yes, we love four-wheel steer because we're children of the
80s. Absolutely. So, yes, and I believe the upper-spec models, you can get four-wheel steer.
Yeah.
And it makes for quite a reduced turning circle for...
Tell you what,
yeah.
Another thing that's just occurred to me about the Audi, which I'll squeeze in before we finish talking about these cars, is that it has a fantastic interior. It's really cool stylish. Audis have always had really high quality interiors, but they've been a bit dull.
Yes.
The Q7 has got a fantastic interior, and it looks really cool. It looks every bit as nice as like a Mercedes-Benz interior, which is saying something.
Which is saying
Mercedes-Benz
quite a lot.
Mercedes-Benz have awesome interiors.
Oh, and just, I want to hark back even further, back to the Volvo.
No, I said we were finishing now.
No, we need to go back to the Volvo just for 1 minute, because if it reads out your text messages to you, it does it in this magnificent voice. That's quite ridiculous. I spent the whole time I had it sending myself text messages. Yeah, just to get it to swear, and it was brilliant. Yeah. It deserves to win just for that alone.
All right.
Anyway, we're starting to fog up here, so I think
But we have a very important job to do. You have to tell me what your pick is.
What my pick?
We predicted correctly last year.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah.
Oh, that's actually a tough one.
It's actually not. It actually is. It's between two for me.
It's probably between two for me, too. I would say...
Well, don't keep us hanging. Spit it out, man.
Either the Volvo or the BMW.
Really?
Those. That's where it comes to for me.
Really? Why the Volvo or the BMW? Why the Volvo?
They just both made massive impressions on me in the time I had them. And they're both very advanced cars.
Yep.
I don't know which one it will... I don't know, to be honest. I haven't sat down and done the actual ranking...
So that's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, which car do you actually think will win? Once all the other idiots who are in the guild with us.
Yes, well, that's a point too, the unpredictable ones.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know.
I don't know.
I would have thought that was a no-brainer, actually.
You would have thought?
What
are you going for?
I'm
going
to come back to that question. Okay. My two picks are the i3 or the CX-3.
Oh, yeah.
The Mazda. Yeah. And they are for very different reasons. The i3, because it's a truly viable electric car. It's an expensive car. It's $83,000.
But
so is every other electric car. An e-tron's in the $80,000 bracket.
I
think for the money,
yes,
you are getting a lot.
Well, you're still getting a BMW
for a start. A true BMW, you're getting a completely advanced, futuristic car, which I look at that car and I think that represents great value for money.
Mm.
It's a truly usable electric car, and it's just... the bravery of the company to actually just design an electric car from the ground up and not use anything from any other BMW.
Absolutely.
The thing about that car is there's nothing in it from any other BMW. No. And it's a completely new car. You know, they could have invented a whole new brand for it.
Well, the screen. Sort of did.
The screen is from that BMW.
It's from another BMW.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway.
That's being very picky. Just trying to steal my thunder.
I am.
The CX-3 for a different reason. It's a thoroughly conventional car in lots of ways, but it's a fantastic... sort of interpretation of a very conventional car. It looks great. It's great to drive. It's great price. It's got a great range. Got good safety technology, and it's just a very aspirational car. It's a mainstream car, but it looks cool. Like anybody would be happy driving that.
And sticking with that, I think that is probably the one that will.
I agree.
Win.
I agree.
Just despite what I would vote for.
But it shouldn't. The BMW should win. But I think that the Mazda will win.
And possibly depending on how many other of our colleagues Mazda gets the MX-5 round to, it could be a surprising outsider.
Yeah,
for
because of course one of the things about the car of the year is that a sufficient number of guild members have to have road tested the car, so it's sort of beholden in car companies to actually get these cars around to people to drive. Once they find out they're on the shortlist, a lot of them go into max attack mode and get the car out to lots of people, and good on them, because that's the whole idea.
Absolutely.
The MX-5 could be a surprise. I think this is probably the first time in the history of the award, which has been going for a very long time, that there have been three cars from one maker.
Since I can remember.
Yeah,
but
it's been a big year for Mazda. Not forgetting that Mazda won last year.
Mm, exactly.
So it could be two in a row. Now, that's happened before. Ford's won two in a row. I think, has Ford won three in a row?
They could have.
I might have to go and have a look. But yeah. Ford has definitely won
Ford's
more
done,
than once in a row.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway. Yes. Anyway, enough of this.
Yes.
Shall we drive?
Yes.
All right. So the car we're sitting in is the Bentley Continental GT, which is quite impressive in itself, but on the end is speed. It's a GT speed. Now I'm just going to click my seatbelt, and I'm going to do something I've been wanting to do for a long time, which is turn it on.
Yes.
Not to hear the engine, although it sounds fantastic, but because we are so very, very hot.
It was a bit misjudged, I think.
And I'm going to put my seat ventilator on, which is on there. And you're probably going to hear the air conditioning kick in there.
But it's fine.
I'm going to turn mine down a bit. I'm going to be 20 degrees. Would you like to be 20
yes,
degrees?
Yes, please. Right. That's lovely.
So, just before we take off... Damien's just turning the fan down a bit so it doesn't interfere with his words of wisdom.
Not saying that the fan in the Bentley is noisy.
But it feels so good.
It does. It feels lovely.
So, Bentley Continental GT Speed. So it's part of the new 2016 range of Continentals. The Continental, if people don't know, is the coupe. How could you not know?
I get a bit confused too, but it's the footballer's Bentley.
It is the footballer's Bentley. It's the two-door one. It's actually been around for a long time, this shape.
Yes, it has.
Probably at least a decade, do you think?
I would think so, yeah.
It's a very familiar car. Yeah. So they've tweaked the shape a bit on this new one. There's sort of a new grille and a new boot lid with a little spoiler on it. Doesn't look hugely different.
Massively different.
But the speed is notable for being the fastest Bentley that has ever been produced.
Which is actually a bit sad when you think about some of the big legendary sort of racing Bentleys and things like that, and this is faster.
Yeah, okay, but let me talk you through it. It's got a 6-litre W12 twin turbocharged engine.
Whoa.
So we might talk a little bit about what W's are in a minute.
So.
It's got 467 kilowatts, so it's got a bit more power than the standard one. It's got 820 newton meters of torque, and that's produced at 2,000 RPM. So basically from idle, you've got 800 newton meters
that's
of torque.
That's quite mental.
It is quite ridiculous. 8-speed automatic transmission. It'll get to 100 k's an hour in 4.2 seconds. And you might think, well, that's pretty fast. You know, there are faster cars.
Yeah.
But need I remind you, this is a 2.5-ton car. It's a big truck.
Yes.
It's a big truck. And Bentleys are famous for being big, heavy cars.
Absolutely.
Even the famous ones back in the 30s.
Oh, absolutely.
They were known for being
trucks.
They
were just immense
trucks.
And had huge engines and were fast.
Now, there's a little pop-up spoiler on the back of this car, and it raises at 140 kilometres per hour, and that's quite handy, because the car will actually do 327 kilometres per hour, which is faster than any other Bentley ever made.
That is just silly.
How much would you pay?
I think if you have to ask that, sir, you probably...
This car is $537,250. So, you know, you pay for the privilege.
you certainly do.
But, you know, it's a Bentley. It's a speed.
It is, and you've got that written in this lovely little...
You have.
...font on the dashboard there, just to remind you.
The speed doesn't look dramatically different from any other Bentleys. I like the name, Speed.
I do.
But it does have some very prominent Speed logos in the interior. There's one behind your head on the headrest, actually. It's embroidered into the seat. There's one on the dashboard. There are Speed logos on the kick plates of the car. And it's got some special interior trim. Stop rattling bits of paper.
I was thinking if there was another badge under there.
No, there isn't. No. But there's special trim. It's sort of got two-tone trim. So it's a bit racier. It's got, aside from the extra power, it's got stiffer suspension. It sits a bit lower. It's all air suspension, obviously. So you're going to raise it up and down, make it.
Is the fancy chrome mesh grill a special speed?
That is an excellent question.
I was wondering that before when I was looking at it.
I've seen lots of Continentals with blacked out grills, which seems to be a thing as
Yeah,
that's a good question, and I wish you hadn't asked it.
Okay,
because
that makes us look a bit underprepared.
Yeah, so we could cut that out.
We possibly could.
So I'm just grabbing hold of the gear lever, which has knurling. We've talked about knurling quite a bit.
Fans of knurling.
We've actually been discussing whether the knurling... There's knurling on the gear lever. We'll put a picture of some knurling.
We do have a picture of...
Or we could reuse that.
We'll reuse that photo of the knurling.
But there is texture on a lot of the other surfaces, like the gear shift pedals and things, which is sort of fake knurling.
Yes.
It's not real knurling, is it?
It's
sort of just a texture, whereas on the gear lever, it is beautiful knurling.
Yes.
I'm touching it
At
now.
Least there is some real knurling in the car,
yeah,
so that's
now,
the main thing.
I'm going to get on with it now and actually drive the thing, and we are going to have a bit of a chat about 12-cylinder cars.
Yes.
Because... they are incredible.
They are.
And you wouldn't think there were that many around.
There's a surprising number.
And actually there are, because we made a list and we were quite staggered.
At this
now,
day and age of...
we're just pulling onto the road here, and there's a man in a Mazda Ute coming, so we're going to wait for him. And then we're going to experience speed, power and four-wheel drive. And it's a very fast car.
It's a very fast car, but it's very... very unique in its acceleration. It's just sort of this...
doesn't frighten you.
No, it doesn't. It's not like...
sneaks up on you.
Yeah. It's just with the four-wheel drive and the sort of constant power and torque of the W12, sorry.
Which is a characteristic of 12-cylinder engines.
Yeah.
And this was explained to me one day by someone in automotive PR, so I'm not going to give him any credit for it. I'm just going to appropriate what he told me and share it with you and pretend that I'm clever.
Yeah.
He said the difference between a V8... in a 12-cylinder engine, and I have to say 12 rather than V12 because this is a W12, is that a V8 engine has the same characteristics as any other sort of engine. It takes a little while to get going, and then most of the power is produced up top. So it's like a normal engine, but it's just more power and more torque. A 12-cylinder engine is absolutely elastic. There's just all of that power and torque anytime you want it over any part of the rev range. It's just truly seamless power, and that's what makes a 12-cylinder engine special. It doesn't necessarily produce more power or torque than a V8 engine or any other kind of engine, although often they do, but it's
the way
they drive.
Does it,
And a good example is this Bentley, I think, because Bentley still makes W12 and V8 Continentals.
Yes, that's right.
And the V8's a great engine, and lots of people rave about it. But the reality is that customers for this kind of car, a lot of them still want a 12.
Apart from the fact that a 12 in a Bentley seems right.
It does.
It suits the feel of the car. The feel of the engine suits the feel of the car so much better than the 8.
And I think it sounds better saying W12 because, Bentley. It all fits. It's appropriate. And let's be honest, if you're buying a $500,000 car and you're right at the top of the market, you kind of want the best one, don't you?
Well, if you're spending $500,000 on a car, you want as many cylinders as possible
you
for
do.
Your money, I'm sorry.
What's the point otherwise?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, a V8 probably makes a lot more sense, but the 12's the one you want.
Yeah.
It's the one I want.
Yeah.
And that's the one I've got at the moment, so
exactly.
I'm very happy.
Exactly. It's not like shaving four cylinders off the engine is going to save you much in terms of fuel consumption, and it's not like you'll care if you're buying a $500,000 Bentley anyway.
Well, you shouldn't. And we've been out driving this car all afternoon, actually, and we've done a couple of 100 k's, and all the petrol's gone. So it's not a car you buy to care about fuel consumption, and nor should you.
No,
it's not that kind of car.
No, exactly. And you're not going to be really driving it enough for it to be an issue anyway, are you? It's sort of...
well, that's probably the reality of cars
exactly.
like this. They're a really special experience, but they don't do a lot of K's anyway. So actually, it's a green choice, actually, when
it
you think
is.
About it, a vehicle
really
like
is.
This.
Yeah. It really is. You're doing the planet a favour buying one of these.
Yeah. So, it's not a nimble car.
No.
It's a 2.5-ton car. It's got four-wheel drive. It's got monster 21-inch wheels on it. Yeah. It's just all about mechanical grip and traction and just endless power.
There's a lot of large performance cars that shrink around you when you get them on a winding road. This isn't one of them. It's just big.
It is big, and it just hangs onto the road, and it just won't let go, and it goes as fast as you dare, basically.
Absolutely.
And that's all I can say, really.
And quite frankly, it wouldn't be right if it wasn't like that, because that's what a Bentley is.
It's proud to be fat.
Yep.
It doesn't care.
No.
It's like, you know, some car makers would trim weight out of a car. Bentley just add more power. Yeah, exactly. It's a valid approach.
It is. It is.
So,
seems to work.
Should we talk about some other V12 cars?
Well, we should. We should. Because when we were sort of talking about this podcast, we realised how many V12 cars there are out there and how many we've sort of actually experienced in the last few years.
And there is actually, we've got quite a list here. We're not going to talk about them all because a lot of them we haven't driven.
Yes.
And, you know, if car distributors aren't going to let us drive their cars, then we're not going to talk about
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
But there is a company that actually, their stock and trade is V12 engines, and that is Aston Martin.
Yes.
They have a lot of V12s.
Yes.
Have you driven many V12 Astons?
I have driven, I'm trying to... Thanks for that, because yes, I have driven one, but I can't actually remember which one.
Do you know why that is? Because they're all almost exactly the same.
I know. It was a few years ago now, and we had that in the Ferrari 599 at the same time.
I think that might have been a DB9.
No, I don't think it was.
Oh, what's the one before the DB9?
God, I'm struggling to remember.
We've just gone past a police car.
It's all right.
Obeying the law.
Yes.
Never catch us anyway.
No.
Aston does a V12 version of the Vantage, which is the tiny, tiny two-seater.
Jeez.
Which is just ridiculous.
Silly.
I haven't actually driven that car. I'd love to, but I think I'd find it terrifying.
Yeah.
They do the DB9, which is a V12.
Yes.
They do the Rapide.
Yes.
Which is the four-door one, which is a V12.
It is.
And they do the Vanquish, which is, the Vanquish is the newest Aston, isn't it?
Yes.
That's a V12 still
looks
as well.
Quite a match, like the others.
And I'm not terribly experienced in any of those cars, but I do think it's interesting that they're all V12s. I did stumble across something while I was looking into some of these vehicles. Aston have just launched a version of the DB9 celebrating the release of the James Bond Spectre movie.
Yes.
And we think that's hilarious for a couple of reasons.
Well, a number of reasons. It's possibly the silliest car they could do for a James Bond celebration.
And given why don't you tell us why that's silly?
James Bond has never driven an Aston Martin DB9.
So James Bond, the Daniel Craig James Bond, drove a DBS, correct?
Yes, that is right. Yes.
And in the Spectre movie, which this car purports to celebrate, what does he drive?
The fictional DB10.
Well, it's not fictional, it exists.
Well, it's real, but it's only been made specifically for the movie, so therefore it is fictional.
Let's not go off on a tangent to James Bond cars.
No, we'll get carried away there.
But anyway, this Spectre DB9 just comes with a whole bunch of trim. It's in a special silver colour, which is called Spectre Silver, apparently. I don't know why there's a silver called Spectre Silver. And it's just got special trim. It's got a James Bond themed startup screen on the information system. It's got apparently the gun barrel, James Bond gun barrel logo on the rear seat divider in the back, and little touches like that.
Yes.
So although we say it's stupid, we secretly want to have a go on it.
Yeah, I still kind of feel though it's the factory approved equivalent of the people that buy an Aston Martin and slap a James Bond themed personalised number plate on it anyway.
Yeah, because owning an Aston makes you exactly like James Bond.
Yeah, we all know that. But it's a strange mixture of extremely cool and just very, very silly. Because
our next car will probably give you a hint that we're moving down a list alphabetically. But we're mixing it up because we did the last one in reverse order.
We did. So,
the next one, BMW still sells a V12 7
they
Series.
They
at
do.
Least for the time being. There's actually a brand new 7 Series coming at the very end of the year. John Key will be enjoying one of those.
He will.
But at the moment, there's still a V12. I have not driven that vehicle. It's very much a limo sort of...
You say they still make a V12 for the time being in BMW. I think as long as they own Rolls-Royce, there will be a V12 and a BMW, because I think they've kind of got to keep doing that.
We'll get to those later.
Yes, and alphabetically speaking, at the end.
Speaking of cars I haven't driven, Ferrari F12 Berlinetta. I haven't driven one of those.
No, neither have I.
I'd like to, please.
Yes,
anybody?
Please, anybody listening?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's pretty cool looking.
Well, the last Ferrari I drove was the 599, which of course... That's so
old. I'm surprised you had a license back then. But anyway, the next one on the list is the Ferrari FF, which I have driven. I actually went to the international media launch for that car and drove it over the Alps, and it was fantastic.
That was the same launch that English journalist punted one into a curb, wasn't it? And busted the wheel.
Yes, it was an action-packed launch.
Yes, it was.
So the FF is sort of Ferrari's, I suppose, the closest thing you'll ever get to a Ferrari SUV.
Yes.
Four-wheel drive, sort of a shooting brake, sort of four-seater.
Four-wheel drive family wagon.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, that's
and that's an example, because lots of V12s are like super smooth and quiet. The Ferrari V12 is very smooth, obviously, but it's not quiet.
It sounds
mad.
Yes.
And actually, Ferrari's heritage in road cars is very much based around the V12.
Yes,
you know,
indeed.
There's lots of V8 Ferraris around now, obviously, but the V12 is still the special sort of models. And in fact, when Ferrari builds its engines, they test them all in a special facility and everything before they put them in a car. They spend a lot more time running in and testing the V12s than they do the V8s. The V8s are sort of like almost dismissed as like, you know, oh my, they're sort of my first Ferrari engines. If you want a real Ferrari, you get a V12 one, and I agree.
I was going to say, is that because the V12's likely to blow up if they don't?
Possibly.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and the Ferrari LaFerrari.
LaFerrari,
which is actually the Ferrari, yes, the Ferrari.
The Ferrari.
This may surprise you. I haven't driven one of those.
Really?
Yes.
Neither have I.
They look pretty cool, though.
They look pretty cool. Apparently, I did an article a while ago about the most powerful engines.
Yes.
In the world, you know, in terms of per litre and things like that. And even without the hybrid boosting system on the LaFerrari, that V12 is still one of the most powerful naturally aspirated engines in the world.
As it should be.
So then they whack on this ridiculous hybrid system and make it even more powerful.
Yeah,
so,
fantastic. Yeah, because of course it's one of those new generations of sort of hypercars which have hybrid power as well, like the Porsche 918 and the McLaren P1. Yeah, pretty cool.
Pretty awesome.
Do you know what? I know I shocked you with that revelation that I hadn't. I've just driven past a whole family of ducks on the road. It's okay. They're all right.
Okay. I missed them cross.
Yeah.
I missed them entirely.
So
lucky I'm not driving then.
Yeah. So even though I shocked you with that revelation that I haven't driven a LaFerrari, I'm also going to shock you with the revelation that I probably never will.
No, we're possibly quite safe.
Yeah. So let's move on. Lamborghini Aventador.
Yes.
I have driven.
You have?
Another company that's famous for its V12 engines. Another company that makes mad V12 engines. It is a fantastic car. I've driven it around the Sepang circuit, actually, in Malaysia.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's a great car. I mean, it makes the...
Yes.
The Huracan is sort of the smaller Lamborghini, which is sort of similar size to an Audi R8, and that's a very exciting car. But the Aventador
makes it seem
like a toy, really.
Yeah, but again, it's like the difference between the Ferrari V8s and the Ferrari V12s. It's the proper one, isn't it?
It is the proper one. Because
it's mental.
It's mad.
Yep, absolutely.
So, next on our list, another bunch of cars I haven't driven. A whole bunch of Mercedes-Benzes. Mercedes-Benz and AMG in particular, you think of them as like a V8 company, and they are.
They are very much.
But there are a lot of V12s lurking there. There's a Mercedes S600 sedan, and of course the Maybach sedan, which we don't have in New Zealand at the moment, but the S600 and the Maybach are both V12s, aren't they?
Yep.
There's the S-Class Coupe is available. We've both driven the S-Class Coupe. Yes. It's a very interesting car, very high-tech car. There's an S63. But there's also an S65. So the S63 is the V8. The S65 is the V12. And I think this is another good example of people who just want a 12 for the way it drives rather than getting a whole lot of extra performance. Because an S63 has a lot of power. It's got 430 kilowatts and 900 newton meters. And I would argue that figure of 900 newton meters is quite deliberate on the part of Mercedes-Benz.
Oh,
I think they've restrained the output of the engine
so that
they could make the S63 463 kilowatts and 1,000 newton meters.
Well, don't they have to actually restrict the S65 to that, because the V12 would produce a lot more.
It would, but it would just shred the tyres as well. Electronic system could keep it in check.
No.
So there's not a huge amount of power
difference
between two cars, but I'll bet you, and I have to say I'll bet you because I haven't driven the V12 one, I've driven the V8 one,
yes,
but I will bet you that they are very different cars to drive. The S63 is all about sort of mad V8 power and you know, all that sort of stuff that you associate with AMG. The S65 will just be super, super smooth.
Yeah.
So yes. If anybody from Mercedes-Benz is listening, I am actually available. And what's last on the list?
Well, probably the car that you would associate with 12 cylinders more than anything else. Rolls-Royce.
Oh, Rolls-Royce. And they're all Rolls-Royce, V12s, aren't they?
Yeah.
So the baby Ghost...
Don't mess around with anything.
...is a V12. The Wraith, which is based on the Ghost, is a V12. The new Dawn, which is based on the Wraith, which we haven't seen here yet. It's going to be here within the year. So the Dawn's like the sort of young person's convertible. That's a V12.
Young being relative terms.
Yeah. The Phantom, which is the big fella, been around for a long time. That's a V12 as well. And all the derivatives of the Phantom, like the drophead and the coupe, they're all V12s as well. And they are, of course, BMW V12s.
Yes,
because BMW owns Rolls-Royce.
Yes. And unlike other cars that are strongly associated with V12s, the Rolls is virtually silent.
It is silent, and it's
extraordinarily quiet.
Another demonstration of the versatility of a V12 engine, because you can make it mad like you can in a Lamborghini, or you can just make it absolutely silent and incredibly smooth, like in a Rolls. Did I mention I've driven all of those Rolls-Royce vehicles?
Yes, well, we have, in fact, done a podcast from one of those vehicles.
That was in the Ghost, wasn't it?
It was the Ghost,
Yeah. And I drove a Phantom recently, which was $1.1 million worth, which is a fantastic car as well.
Hilarious.
It was hilarious.
It's just immense.
I think that's the thing about Rolls-Royces, they're actually fun. They're not pretentious, they're just fun.
Yeah.
That's why everyone should have one.
Yes.
Have you got any V12 engine facts that you can share with us?
Well, I've got several 12-cylinder engine facts that are
of
quite
Of course, sorry.
Because we're going,
Because we're in a W12.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, I think, just jump straight into this one particular fact I have about it. I mean, the V12's associated, well, the 12-cylinder engine in general is associated with, you know, sports cars and, of course, Formula One. Formula One was V12 for a very long time.
Yeah.
But since we're in a W12, you'd think, well, you know, V12s have been in Formula One, V12s have been successful in motor racing. Surely the W12 would make a great racing engine. Well, no, it seems that's not the case.
But it has been raced.
Well, technically, no. It's been tried. The first W12 that appeared in Formula One was in the 1990 season, and it was after an engine company called Life bought the rights for a W12 design off an ex-Ferrari engineer who had worked in the mid-60s on developing a W18 engine for Ferrari that never came to light. He got made redundant or fired or who knows, whatever, left the company, but carried on developing this W configuration. And anyways, he worked on this thing, and it's this a bloke called... God, what's his name there? Ernesto Vita.
Sounds like you're reading that.
Well, it would. I had to read that. Ernesto Vita. And Vita, of course, means life in Italian.
Oh, of course.
So that's where life
I see what he did
from.
There.
He did. He was clever. Yeah. He was hoping to make a quick buck, basically, and flog the W12 into Formula One. And it was right in the era when the turbo engines had been banned, so there were a lot of new engine manufacturers coming in and a lot of weird configurations of engines. There was a flat 12 that was run under the Subaru name.
Wow.
Which was a miserable failure. Judd and Yamaha were in Formula One, and of course Renault and Honda had just introduced the V10, which was new. So that, of course, went on to be successful. Nothing else did. But anyway, after trying to flog this W12 off to a few teams, no one was interested. So Ernesto decided, what's the best way to make a quick buck in Formula One? Start your own team. Well, no, maybe not.
No. Sounds like a good way to lose a fortune.
It does. Well, he went about it the right way. By the right way, I mean the completely wrong way. He bought an old chassis from a previous failed Formula One
team. Oh, that always works, buying something that no one else
Absolutely.
Wants anymore. Yeah.
Threw this W12 in the back of it. Turned up at the first race of the 1990 season with one car, one engine, and no spare parts, which is always a good way to go racing.
That's a great way to go racing.
Failed to qualify. Failed to qualify for the next 13 races in a row.
Lucky number, though.
So 14 races in a row, didn't qualify for it once. Turned out to be about two-thirds as powerful as the next least powerful car on the grid. And on top of that was also the heaviest car in the field.
I have to stop you there, and I have to stick up for the W configuration. You're saying it's not successful in racing. What you're actually telling me is the one man who tried to race it was an idiot.
Basically, yeah. Yes. It didn't have the best life.
Okay.
So eventually they dumped the W12 and tried to put a Judd V8 in the back of the car.
Yeah.
But they found that the engine cover didn't fit. And it sums up the team that they discovered this fact during the first lap of practice when the engine cover blew off. So after that, they gave up and didn't race in the last two races of the season. So the W12 doesn't have exactly a glittering Formula One career.
No.
But it is doing relatively well in GT3 at the moment with Bentley.
Yeah, well, I mean, so Bentley, owned by Volkswagen, of course.
Yeah, of course.
They've had a fairly long run with the W engine. It's not a configuration that's caught on anywhere else,
no,
I have to say.
No, not at all, not at all.
Volkswagen had a W8 for a while in the Passat.
That was a miserable failure.
It was a miserable failure.
I think the thing, they call this a W12, and it's being a wee bit tricky, a bit cheeky, I think, there, really, because it's two VR6 engines, which is the narrow-angle V6 that Volkswagen...
Yeah.
I believe they still actually use it.
I don't know if that's right, but there was at one time a Golf called the VR6, and yeah, they had that engine.
But the VR6, it's a 15-degree V6, so it's basically just slightly a slightly crooked inline six. Yeah. And in fact, VR is the VR in VR comes from the German word that I can't remember now for inline. So technically, Volkswagen even call it a V inline. Six.
That is a fact.
That is a fact, and that is fact. True because the Wikipedia told me that.
The thing I like about these engines, and I liked about the Golf, and I like about this Bentley that we're driving,
yes.
We just pulled up at a roundabout and stopped, and I noticed it just warbles. It's got a great noise.
It's got a fantastic noise.
Like, it's a smooth engine, but it's got this warbling sort of soundtrack, which is absolutely unique, and I'm sure that's what a lot of people like about it.
Yeah.
It just sounds great.
Well, again, it just
goes
really well with the character of the car.
It does, yeah.
And then it does that.
Yeah.
Hang on, my spleen's back there somewhere.
It's not that bad.
Oh, fairly quick.
All right, well, look, I've enjoyed this chat about 12 engines. Probably not as much as I've enjoyed driving this car.
No, driving
this car is not something I can share with everybody, whereas we can chat.
Absolutely.
We are now going to travel in time.
Magically.
To last week.
Yes, through the magic of clever editing, or not so clever.
Because we had a chat, sort of from one extreme to the other. We're here in a $500,000, I almost said Bugatti.
I know.
We're here in a $500,000 Bentley. But last week we actually had a chat with James Freeman, who is the founder and boss of Shitbox Rallies, which is an intriguing sort of event that's been running in Australia for many years.
We have talked about it before.
We have.
On the podcast, in fact.
Bringing it to New Zealand. He was in New Zealand last week. After we've had a chat with James, I think we'll travel back to the present and sign off in the Bentley. So we'll see you again shortly here.
We won't see you because it's a podcast, but we'll talk to you soon.
There could be pictures.
There could be.
Okay, so due to the magic of technology, we're back, and we've actually shifted to the Hilton Hotel on a beautiful Friday night in Auckland. You're going to hear a little bit of noise in the background, probably. We're right next to a room where a fairly substantial awards ceremony is going on, I think.
Seems to be the case, yeah.
It's Friday night, people are partying, that's okay. But we're here with James Freeman from Australia. James is the founder of the Shitbox Rally. He's here in New Zealand doing a bit of work on that, and we thought it'd be great to have a chat with him. Probably Shitbox Rally gets everybody's attention, just the name, but James, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I am responsible for that that name. Shitbox is something that I launched back in 2009, and it's something that came from a multitude of different things, but the main catalyst was from a pretty horrible story, really, which was... that I lost both of my parents to cancer within 12 months of each other.
Yeah.
And that obviously had an enormous impact on me, and I wanted to do something pretty substantial for it. And I recently moved back to Australia from living overseas, and I wanted to discover Australia a little bit more, and road trips were always the best way of doing that kind of thing. So a combination of a desire to see more of Australia, and to also raise funds and raise awareness led me down this path that ended up being Shitbox Rally. And our first rally we did in 2010, and I knew we had a something that could end up being really successful based on the fact that the first rally, with only 18 teams or something, I was hoping we'd raise something like 60 grand. We ended up raising a little over 100 grand.
You say only 18 teams. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
for your first go.
Well, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. I was really pleased with it. And I only say 18 teams now, considering the rallies now are about 250 teams.
Wow. Oh, okay.
So that's the reason why I say 18 teams. But we've been doing the rally now in Australia for... we're in its... it's seventh year coming up now in Australia, and I had wanted for a while to expand the rally internationally, and New Zealand is really the perfect sort of fit for the first foray internationally, really, because obviously we're close together. The language is the same. We're all driving on the same side of the road.
The
language is sort of the same. There are some differences. Definitely.
Although shitbox sounds better when you say it.
It does. It's got you got a much better.
I think it quite sounds quite good when it rolls off your tongue as well. So we've launched in New Zealand with the first rally taking place in February. For me, it's going to be exciting because we're doing it in somewhere completely different. In Australia, we've zigzagged across quite a lot.
Okay.
But now we get to do it in New Zealand.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about what constitutes a shitbox rally? Why is it called the shitbox rally? It's to do with the vehicles, isn't it?
Yeah. So a shitbox is a car of absolute poor quality and poor reliability. So in Australia, of course, we say that the value of the vehicle can't be any more than $1,000.
Yeah.
And where lies the challenge is it's not a race at all, and you'd be stupid to think that you could possibly ever drive these vehicles fast, but it's a challenge to see whether you can actually get to the finish line.
Yeah.
So in Australia, we drive, 3,500 kilometres all the way across the country in 7 days in these vehicles that are worth no more than $1,000. And when I say the vehicles aren't worth more than $1,000, you can't buy it for $1,000 and then spend more money on it.
Right.
You buy it for $1,000, that's it.
Okay.
That's your
right.
budget.
You've got $1,000.
Total, yeah.
So are competitors free to choose their own vehicles? How do you source all these vehicles?
Yeah, in Australia, competitors are free to choose their own vehicles. In New Zealand, we're doing it slightly differently.
Yeah.
For the first year, we've got a bunch of Australian teams that are coming in, but it's really good because we've got a number of New Zealand teams doing it as well. So for the New Zealand rally, the budget is just a little bit higher, not by much, but it includes the registration and insurance as well.
Yeah.
And we work with our partners, Mannheim, who helped us, who go out and source the vehicles for us. So
okay.
It's really quite fun. This way the teams get to start the rally. All they need to do is do all their fundraising beforehand. They can start the rally without a car, obviously, which is where it gets interesting. And they come and have a look at the vehicles, and then we have an auction. So we base the auction based on how much money they've raised already. So, yep.
So is there a minimum amount that teams have to raise to compete?
They have to raise $4,000.
Yeah.
Okay. But then from there that we look at whoever raises the most is therefore in the better position for bidding for the auction.
Yes.
They'll end up getting the car they want.
Yeah.
So it ends up being quite a good level playing field.
Yeah.
With that regard. And then off we disappear if the rest of the rally is exactly the same as it is in Australia.
So how long is the New Zealand rally going to be?
It's 7 days still.
7 days? What sort of distance?
We're doing around 2,700 kilometres.
Wow, so still substantial.
Still substantial, yeah. Definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Probably harder to find 2,700 kilometres worth of roads in New Zealand than it is in Australia. You can just keep driving in Australia.
In Australia, you just
go in a straight line. Yeah.
And keep driving. Whereas here, you've got to zigzag around a lot. So we are seeing a lot. We're keeping the rally for the first year in the North Island.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And so we are zigzagging around a lot, for sure. I did most of the first days route yesterday, actually.
Yeah.
Just get a little bit of a feel for the different conditions.
So can you just give us a sort of a rough idea of where competitors are going to go? Where do you start off?
We'll start off at Mannheim, which is reasonably close to the airport.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we're heading south. So we head south. We're staying somewhere a little bit further out from Inglewood, so down towards New Plymouth and across. But we don't take the normal roads. and that's one of the things with the rallies in Australia, we always go pretty remote, and that's the point with this one as well. So
river crossings and so on.
We'll definitely take the roads less travelled.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So has history taught you that there are particular types of cars and ages of cars that are better than others for this sort of thing? You must have built up quite a database of car reliability statistics by now.
Yeah, we have. We have. I don't think we necessarily learn from that. I'm probably one of the worst culprits with that. I have an old Rover SD1, which when it was brand new was known as one of the least reliable vehicles you could ever
have. Gotta say, that's not a vehicle that springs to mind.
No, it's not. It's still a good chance of that breaking down on every rally.
Photogenic, though.
It looks good, sounds good, and that's really where it stops. Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, your Falcons and your Commodores and things, they're your safer choices.
Yeah, so big and tough.
They're tough, you can run them into things and it doesn't really bother them too much. Your wheels, obviously, and the tyres make an enormous difference.
Yeah.
But those vehicles are good, they can take quite a lot of punishment. But then you'll be amazed with how far and how well you can travel in a shitbox. You know, we've done so many rallies now, and generally speaking, we usually lose, on average, we usually lose about 9% of vehicles.
That's pretty good.
Which is excellent.
That's very impressive.
But we have a lot that break down.
Yeah.
We have a lot that we need to do work on, for sure, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's that 9% of vehicles that don't make it at all.
Yeah.
When you're taking $1,000 cars into pretty remote places over an extended period of time, it's pretty good going.
Yep.
It's incredible.
So it's obviously it's growing fairly rapidly, even in a few years. You're talking about 250 teams in Australia. What's the reason for that? Are people attracted to the cause? Are they attracted to the idea of cheap cars going a long way?
Yeah, I think people are attracted to a mixture of things. It's definitely the cause. We have a lot of people that come on the rally that have their own cancer story. So that definitely is one of them. But I think it's more so than that. I think the way that we go about the fundraising is different. We target it differently. So it's a non-traditional method for fundraising.
Yeah.
It's also added, therefore, with a lot of humour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing. You can actually go at fundraising for cancer research, but base it around some really good humour. And then with that, is this adventure. It is an adventure. For New Zealand, as I said, we're bringing a lot of Australian teams in, but even with the Kiwi teams that are doing the rally, we're going to take them to places that they haven't been before.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's awesome. It's really, really awesome. And we do that in Australia. We take people to places they've never, ever been to before and usually won't ever go to again. But we open up parts of the country for people to be able to see and go, this is magnificent. We really must come back here.
So who has helped you plan out these routes in New Zealand?
I work with really good mapping software, first of all.
Yep.
And that's critical. That's the critical base that you've got to start with. And then from there, it's really local knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In any of the rallies that I do, it's local knowledge. And then the last thing is just a bit of a wing and a prayer.
Yeah.
So with any route that you do, you can plan it down to a meticulous detail. But when it all comes down to it, the weather has a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it could be the best route that you could ever plan ever, and then it could go completely sideways if there's a bad storm that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only take that really too far. You just have to make sure you're properly prepared on any given day.
And so what sort of crowd are you expecting for the New Zealand event? How many teams have you got booked in already?
We're doing 75 teams for the New Zealand rally.
So you're off to quite a big start.
Yeah, I wanted 75. So we're pretty.
How many of those are Aussie and how many in New Zealand?
We probably have about a 15-20% from New Zealand.
Outnumbered.
Yeah. And that will certainly change from year two, assuming that year one goes well. And we'd hope that those ratios will get back to being even, or swap over so that we've got more Kiwi teams.
Mm-hmm.
We naturally have more Australian teams because our database is Australian teams that want to do the Australian rally.
Damn.
So we've got a bunch of people that have done the Australian rally that are coming over to do New Zealand. We've got a bunch of people that have done no rallies that are coming over from Australia to do the New Zealand rally.
I mean, you obviously, do you have a sort of a core of hardcore people who just do it every year?
Yeah, we get a decent return rate.
Yeah.
For sure. It's I wouldn't say that we've got a huge amount of people that do absolutely every single rally, but we've got a really, really good return rate. What we do also have is a great support crew.
Yeah.
So the great thing about the Chipbox is that you don't need to know anything about motor mechanics. You don't need to understand how cars work.
That was actually going to be my question. I was going to chip in with then, is it?
Yeah. If you, we've had people that come on the rally that don't even know how to put oil in the car. By the end of it, they are
probably no point because oil probably comes out again.
comes out very quickly. But the point is that you should be able to come on the rally feeling comfortable with the fact that you don't have to do any of the work yourself.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
When saying that, we have great qualified mechanics that come on the rally as rally teams, but then we have our support crew.
So how big is your support crew?
For this particular rally, we'll be sort of 6 to 7 teams.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we have our four-wheel drives. We have car carrying trailers.
Yep.
If a car breaks down, we can put it on a trailer. We can take it into camp and work on it there. Much safer if we can. I mean, we've learned a lot over the years. It's much safer if we can work on the vehicles when we're in camp than on the side of the road.
Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Also need to make sure that the crews and the support crews get into camp so they get fed and put up their tents, same as everybody else. So, we've got it down to a pretty nice art now that works quite well. But it's this big rolling festival really, and but it comes together nicely. So New Zealand will throw in a whole different challenge to us because it's going to be things that are new for most of us, you know. So it's great to have that local knowledge that we'll have from the Kiwi teams on the rally as well.
So you're expanding from Australia to New Zealand. Presumably you're thinking hard about going a few other places as well if this goes well. Is this type of fundraising sort of turned into your full-time job, or do you have a day job still?
I don't have another full-time job.
Yep.
The rally is something that definitely takes up most of my time.
Yep.
It really does. And I, on the first year, when I did the first rally, I did have a full-time job, and it suffered. It definitely suffered.
Yeah.
So I knew, and then also with the success from the first one, I realised this thing has potential to become something really, really wonderful, but it needed me to dedicate time. And I was in a position where I was able to dedicate a couple of years and just say, you know what, I'm just going to put 2 years into this and see if we can build it up into something. And we've been able to, and now the rally is... we are the largest single fundraiser for the Cancer Council in Australia.
Wow.
We've raised over $6.5 million in the last 6 years.
That's amazing.
And we hope to be able to, maybe we might not be able to replicate the numbers, but we hope to be able to be in a similar sort of position with New Zealand putting the funds into the Cancer Society here in New Zealand.
Yeah, well that's fantastic. I think that's a fantastic effort. You're obviously having a lot of fun along the way, but it's a great cause, and you've done an amazing job.
Thank you very much.
So when can we expect to see the rally kick off in New Zealand?
It's in February. I believe, I should know this off by heart, but it's...
that's all right, sure we never know anything when we talk.
The 9th of February, we kick off in New Zealand, and as I said, it's going to be from Auckland. And usually in Australia we go from one part of the country to the other part of the country, but in New Zealand we're going to do a loop. We'll come back to New Zealand, back to Auckland in at the end of those 7 days, but we would have seen a decent amount of the North Island in that time. It's going to be quite an adventure.
Brilliant. All right, well look, congratulations with all the success we've had so far. I hope it goes really well in New Zealand, and we'll look forward to seeing some shit boxes on the road in February.
Thanks mate, do appreciate it.
Thank you.
One more thing actually before we go, are you still taking entries, or is entries...
Yeah, we're still taking entries.
Okay.
Where people
is that
can
just
go
through your website?
Through the website, shitboxrally.co.nz.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And then they can put their details down there. Yeah, I mean, we'd love to have some more Kiwi teams involved, for sure.
Are you capping it at a set level, or are you just open to whoever?
No, we will definitely cap it, but there are going to be a few more teams. I mean, it's the way that the rallies work. You know, there's always going to end up being a couple of team places that will open up.
Yep.
But we'd love to have some more Kiwi teams involved. And as I said, we'd love to get to a point where those ratios start to even out and swap around over the coming years and really make it a great Kiwi event.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much. And that was our fascinating discussion with James Freeman, who was a lovely bloke.
He was a lovely bloke. He was quite tired.
He was extremely tired.
Driving basically non-stop for several days.
And he told us at the end of the interview that he had to get up at some ridiculous hour in the morning to fly back to Australia too. So thank you, James, for your time.
Yeah, it's a great. It sounds like a great
it
event. We were actually quite keen to do it, but I don't think I can do that now. I've got a real job.
No. It's one of those things that sounds like a great idea at the time, and you think, well, hell, that's a whole week though.
Yeah, I'll stick to the Bentley. Anyway, it's been great to be back. We promise not to leave it quite so long next time.
No, we'll be a bit more organised from now on, we promise.
And don't forget to visit where?
Podcasts.nz for all your podcasting needs.
Cars and other things.
It's the home of all of our family of podcasts that we are part of, including the New Zealand Tech Podcast, New Zealand Entertainment Podcast,
New Zealand Business Podcast,
and of course us.
Yeah.
So check it out, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.